Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 4 years ago, Hurricane Katrina roared into the Gulf Coast with a bullseye on New Orleans. As the country watched the devastation that followed, the possibility was raised that our nation had lost a great city and a vital cultural landmark, perhaps forever. Now, in 2009, New Orleans is still there, but still picking up the pieces. We're checking in with folks who lived through it. This hour on Point, New Orleans, 4 years after Katrina. You can join the conversation. What are you hearing from family, friends in New Orleans? Have you traveled to New Orleans since Katrina? And we'd like to give a special welcome to new listeners to the program at WKU Public Radio in Kentucky. Please give us a call. Joining me now from New Orleans, three big voices from the Big Easy. Jarvis DeBerry is an editorial writer and columnist for the Times-Picayune. Jarvis DeBerry, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie. How are you?
Glad to have you with us. Julia Reed is a contributing editor and food columnist for Newsweek. Her most recent book is The House on First Street, My New Orleans Story. Julia Reed, who also wrote for a long time for Vogue magazine, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jackie.
And we're also joined by author and investigative reporter Jason Berry. He's co-author of Up From the Cradle of Jazz, New Orleans Music Since World War II, which is releasing in a new edition this year. And he's the author of many other books, including the comic novel set in the world of Louisiana politics, Last of the Red Hot Papas. Jason Berry, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much, Jackie. Good to be with you.
Well, you know, we thought we'd have you all walk us through that day 4 years ago. I think that it's a point of departure like no other, certainly like no other in that area. And we find it's good to have a sort of base point. So you were all there, I believe, and maybe someone would like to take us back. Who'd like to go first?
I'll start. This is Jarvis. I was here as a journalist for the Times-Picayune. We were asked, required to stay in the city as the storm approached. That weekend was a weekend of just impending dread. I felt like a character in a monster movie, really, just waiting for the big, ugly, bad monster to jump out.
Mm-hmm.
When that did actually happen, when the winds picked up that Monday morning, there was also a sense of relief because, according to all the weather reports, the storm had seemingly miraculously diverted itself toward the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. We went out that afternoon to survey the city to see what was happening. Did see some flooding, but generally thought that, for the most part, the city was better than we thought it was going to be the day before. Later that night, and especially the next morning, you could look around and see what once was land wasn't land anymore. It was just this crazily strange-looking seascape, almost, just water as far as you could see in all directions. And you never, ever expect to see your home, the city that you love, completely submerged underwater.
So it took time for your mind to catch up with the sensory overload, it sounds like.
It was a perfect stillness, but deadly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for those, I mean, I was not actually here, and so Jarvis was looking at this. But for those of us, I left with my husband like really late Sunday night, and I went back to my hometown in Mississippi. And the whole time in the car, I drove my husband insane because we'd been working on a house that we'd moved into about a week before for a whole year, and it was by no means finished. And I kept thinking, the house is going to be gone. The house is going to be gone. And he kept telling me, just really calm down. I've looked at the maps. It's moving to the east, which it did. So by the time we got to Mississippi at 3 o'clock in the morning and we woke up and everything seemed to be fine because we had no information. Unlike Jarvis, most of us couldn't look out a window, and there was nothing getting through in those early hours. So like so many people that evacuated, I went to bed Monday night, even though there was not even electricity that far north. I mean, I'm about 5 hours north on the river. We celebrated by candlelight that night with a whole bunch of other evacuees, and it was early the next morning when finally the news had gotten to the rest of the world. You know, I think my mother banged on the door and said, "Get up, the whole city's underwater." And I thought, oh, my God, you always exaggerate. But
there was no exaggeration.
No exaggeration.
Yeah. And Jason, were you there?
Well, not exactly. I left that Saturday before the storm hit on Monday, went to my brother's home in Covington, Louisiana, which is about 30 miles across Lake Pontchartrain, and was there with family members. The storm passed, and it was just a harrowing experience, even that far north of the city. Of course, all the electricity was out. The wind was bellowing. In fact, the thing that really struck me was the sound undulations of the wind. It would go from these deep bellows, just rising up the octaves to this high, keening whine, and the bay window blew out. Lamar's home is on the Bogofalaya River. In fact, we were right across the river from where Walker Percy had lived, and he did a famous novel, Love in the Ruins, which is subtitled The Adventures of a Bad Catholic at a Time Near the End of the World. And on several occasions over the next 4 days, as we struggled to get out because of fallen trees, we had cause to remember that novel. I heard, I guess it was toward the end of Monday and deeply into Tuesday, on a battery-powered radio, the most harrowing stories, personal accounts, people trapped in attics and on WWL radio here in New Orleans. And, you know, I remember one DJ, that's not the correct term, one Dave Cohen, the news director, I believe, of WWL, saying at one point, "New Orleans is over. Where do I live?" And those words really stayed with me as if surgically implanted. I ended up joining four or five people, a veterinarian, stockbroker, a couple other guys with these small chainsaws that were not meant to be used on large oak trees. And we managed to carve our way part of the way out. And I got a terrible case of poison ivy. And we were on the road for about 6 weeks after that.
In many ways, the recovery effort goes on to this minute. We've got the rest of the hour to talk about that. But for all of you, it's as you come back that the sort of horror quotient begins to fill up. Julia, I got your book late last night and was sort of speed reading through. You'll forgive me, but that happens sometimes. And you had such a graphic experience with the Oklahoma National Guard out looking for.
Well, they were the guard that was in my neighborhood. So I came back fairly a few days into the storm.
Which is in the historic Garden District.
Garden District, yeah. Right. And which is like the French Quarter on high ground. Mm-hmm. There was no threat of flooding. I did see my neighbor's entire roof unfurled at the end of our block. Just the whole thing just peeled off like a sardine can. But other than that, you know, the damage was like normal wind damage in a normal hurricane, because what we had was not a hurricane damage. It was flood damage. So, I mean, the bulk of the city. And the bulk of the city when I got back was still very much underwater. The National Guard had not been called out till, they didn't get there until almost a week into it. So it has been pretty chaotic up until then, and these guys from Oklahoma had been working pretty hard, and they let me go out with them in their Humvees and in their boats, and it was pretty grim. I mean, a lot of the water had receded. You could get, but once we got to Claiborne Avenue, which was one of the main thoroughfares, it parallels St. Charles Avenue, which tourists know from the streetcars and stuff, and it was still just terrific. You know, there were decomposing bodies floating still in the water, dogs on the roofs of, you know, there's like vast housing projects over there. So roofs the size of football fields with these wild dogs, who are now, you know, terrified, most of them pit bulls. I mean, it was horrible. You know, the National Guard, I think, was more scared of the dogs than anything else. They were sort of, you know, under shoot to kill orders on these poor dogs that were starving to death on the roofs. It was awful. But
you write in the book that they had a shoot to kill order if, in fact, a dog was molesting human remains.
Yeah, I mean, and there had obviously been a lot of that on the bodies that were there. I mean, you could tell how caught unawares a lot of these people were. I mean, they were, you know, there were just cars stopped in the middle of the road with people. You could see that people had been trying to get out. Some bad guys had been trying to loot, and you could see stuff in the cars, halfway loaded in the cars, and then they'd abandoned it. And then good guys just trying to sort of beat the flood water out, but in both cases, just doors wide open, cars abandoned, you know, and just not being able to move as fast as the water. Because, I mean, I talked to people who live on that side of St. Charles Avenue afterwards, later on in the book, and they were telling me their stories. You know, and they too had, like, taken refuge, say, in a gym, you know, at a school where a friend of, you know, this woman that I know had a friend who was a school janitor, so they let them all sleep in the gym. They think they're fine. They get out. They had no way to know that the water was heading right in their neighborhood. They were, you know, grilling on the corner in their street just to get rid of the contents of their refrigerator, and a cop happens to come by and says, you know, y'all better move it. But the cop can't give them any gas. The cop can't give. I mean, you know, so it was that kind of deal. I mean, nobody. Most people in town that thought they had survived might as well have been in Mississippi with me, because they weren't getting any more information than I was.
Correct.
You know, there was no way until you saw the water moving.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about New Orleans, 4 years on, and where the city stands in its recovery. We're joined this hour by three New Orleans voices. Jarvis DeBerry is editorial writer and columnist for the Times-Picayune. Julia Reed is a contributing editor at Newsweek and author of The House on First Street, My New Orleans Story. And Jason Berry is an author and investigative reporter, co-author of Up from the Cradle of Jazz, New Orleans Music Since World War II. Jarvis, you didn't get quite as much time in that first section as everyone else did. So you said that you, unlike Julie and Jason, stayed through over the hurricane weekend. What were some of your first impressions when you went out? And then we'll get to where New Orleans is today.
The first impressions going out were that this is really bad, seeing people on their rooftops. The Coast Guard had rescued quite a few people and had brought them to the interstate. I since have had to reconsider what I think of the word rescue, because although they were pulled out of life-threatening flooding situations, they were then put on the interstate, and many were shoeless, barely clothed, walking aimlessly with no possessions whatsoever, trying to figure out what to do, where to go. Seeing that situation replicated over and over and over and over again as we drove as far east as we could go that day was just almost paralyzing. But I remember standing out on Interstate 10, because there was really no traffic except for the reporters and the emergency vehicles that were on the interstate, saying to myself, well, my house is probably gone. I'm going to have to do some work. And at that point, it was just trying to chronicle what was happening to this city so that other people would know it and respond to it.
Yeah. Was your house gone, by the way?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was. And I didn't see it until about a month after that. And that was one of probably my most emotional columns, because I couldn't get in the door. The door was rusted shut. Climbed into the window, excuse me, and couldn't get into my bedroom because the door was swollen shut. And it didn't hit me until later, all the things that I had forgotten to remove from the house, these quilts that my grandmother had made especially for me, other items that you don't really think about when you're told that you have 48 hours to pick up everything. And to me, that has been an amazing part of the story of people here. Just asking people, what did you lose? I got a call last week from a man who said that he lost his deceased girlfriend's ashes in the storm. Mm-hmm. And their stories of that kind of poignancy all over the city.
Yeah, you wrote in one of your columns, too, that you'll there are things that that people think they'll have that you'll never have again, like
yes.
high school graduation photos and family photos and things like that.
Correct.
Well, here it is. 4 years on from a weekend, I think we can all remember what we were, at least certainly in the world of journalism, what we were doing, listening to, preparing for. And it is still something that is as much on our minds today. And well, perhaps not as much. Well, that's, I think, one question. Where are we today? And how much is the city in the national consciousness? And how much ought it to be there? And we have the happy accident of all three of you being in one studio, and feel free to, you know, bomb in on each other because I like that. It's nice to have you all together. What do you think? I mean, have we moved on? Have we forgotten about New Orleans?
Well, I travel a lot, and last summer I was on a book tour when this book came out in hardback, and everywhere I went, you know, whether it was Miami or Austin or Los Angeles, not particularly, you know, southern-centric cities, people would, you know, the book signing would last much longer than most book signings, I'm happy to say, because people had questions not about the book so much as the city. What's it like? What's the food like? Can I come back? Those kinds of things. And that was 3 years out, so I was pretty happy and gratified that people were still wanting to know. By this summer, I don't get the same response at all. I mean, people, now it's just sort of regular questions like, so is the food still really good? You know, it's not. It's sort of like it's not. They've kind of forgotten about what made this happen in the first place. It's not. There's not any urgency or any concern about. Nobody's asking about the condition of the levee so much as, you know, is it okay to come back and eat and are the hotels clean?
I think that's a sort of natural response in a way for people in other parts of the country because. You know, as terrible as 9/11 was, within 3 or 4 years, most people were not thinking every day about airplanes smashing into skyscrapers. And in like
sure.
fashion, the terrible, you know, pictures of the flooding and the human suffering here, people do want to move on. I think what is difficult, and I don't assume to speak for my two good colleagues here, but I think what many people here feel is not so much the abandonment of the federal government anymore, although I'm certainly willing to concede there's a lot more help that we need and should have gotten. But the real problem, in my view, is that we've been so betrayed by our own political system.
No question. That's the question I do get, besides if the restaurant's good, why did y'all reelect Rene?
Well, exactly. But, you know, if you think about if ever a city had a crying need for a congressman, it was New Orleans after the flood, and Bill Jefferson, of course, was on the way to being indicted and has since been convicted for, you know, the $90,000 and the freezer and mm-hmm. the other things. But the thing that gives me hope is that for all of the failure of politics, the cultural revival in this city has been profound and very moving to watch. And I wrote several long sections for the new edition of Up from the Cradle of Jazz. And in interviewing so many musicians, I was struck time and again by the resilience that many of these artists showed in coming back. One quick cameo. In February of 2006, when the Bush White House was trying to avoid giving information by subpoena to one of the House investigating committees, Wynton Marsalis, the head of jazz at Lincoln Center, was giving out checks totaling $2.8 million raised in a telethon from September, within days of the storm. All these New Orleans musicians flooded out, had gotten to New York, performed on national television, raised $2.8 million. And here was Marsalis, you know, 5 months after the storm, overseeing the distribution of $100,000 to the New Orleans Museum of Art, $100,000 to the Ogden Museum. I believe Julia, if I'm not mistaken, is on the board there or very active there. Individual artists got $15,000 each. Here you have a musician doing what elected officials should have done, giving out the money to help people. And I think in many ways that cameo is a sort of story writ small, as we've seen so many musicians and artists and writers return.
That is certainly true. I remember being on Charlie Rose with Walter Isaacson and a couple other people from New Orleans like a day or two after the storm, and everybody was saying, oh, my God, you know, the musicians won't come back. The cooks won't come back. We're going to lose the culture. And, you know, I got a month, literally a month after the storm, I am on the board of the Ogden Museum, and we have a music night every Thursday called Ogden After Hours, and a local musician comes play. And usually we get about 200 or 300 people in there. The first one we had after the storm, there were more than 1,000 people there, and that was like, you know, there weren't 10,000 people in town, and the people who were there were like poor Jarvis, who probably couldn't have made it too exhausted to come hear music, and you know, insurance guys, but everybody there wanted to see for themselves. Oh my God, that really they're still going to be Walter Wolfman Washington is going to still be playing his guitar. Museum's doors were open. We raised money for Winton's Higher Ground Fund. I do think that the culture drove the Renaissance. I mean, there's a line in my book where I say, you know, it was the chefs who saved us. I mean, part of that was, I mean, it wasn't too much of an exaggeration. I mean, when restaurants opened, people just fell upon them. It was like a community bulletin board just to see, like, if other people had come back. It's the only place. I mean, cell phones still didn't work in those days. You couldn't call up somebody and say, message. How's your house? Is your mother alive? Whatever.
Well,
I mean, let's
let some of our listeners get in on this, because we've had a lot of response, as you might imagine, with the Great American City. Daniel is calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, Jackie. So I was very interested by this discussion. I think it's really great this is happening. But when Hurricane Katrina happened, so many of us were, there's all this discussion about why this is happening, what's wrong with our society that this can happen, that not only do we have a hurricane breaking a levee that we knew could be broken by hurricanes that do visit this coast, but that people aren't being rescued, they aren't getting homes that are adequate, the National Guard is coming in with live ammunition and has given shoot-to-kill orders. We had African Americans trying to flee the city and being turned back at gunpoint from white neighborhoods. And now, not only was the—I mean, I think I like the discussion about politicians failing, but it seems to me more than failing people, because we had all this public housing that was very good public housing that wasn't even touched by the storm or the flood, which was then subsequently bulldozed and is now being replaced by all kinds of for-profit commercial. Industry there, and it seems to me like there was that Hurricane Katrina was very much a warning to the rest of the country about what is going to happen to us, which is very much what this economic crisis has been all about. You know, we're all not only being left behind, but systematically being driven from our homes and driven from our jobs for people who are then profiting off of our misfortune.
Okay, Daniel, thanks. Let's break that down a little bit. And Jarvis, certainly.
Yes, my colleagues are pointing at me.
They are, aren't they? Well, I can't see them, but I'm pointing at you too.
I think
Daniel raises some excellent points.
He does. I would say to Daniel at first that, you know, he's right that some of the housing projects here in New Orleans were largely unscathed by Katrina. That isn't to say that they were good, decent places to live. I know that there are people who have protested against the demolition of some of the public housing. I have always found the large-scale public housing developments in New Orleans to be one of the saddest features of the cityscape. Mm. And I think that far too many people were trapped in poverty. When I first saw with my own eyes the St. Thomas, I was astonished that anybody was actually living there. I couldn't believe in an American city that we were standing silently by.
That had just been torn down before the
hurricane. And that
had
just been torn down before the hurricane.
And let me just add this one thing. When I was with the National Guard and we were going through, I think it was Pete Housing Project, they look, oh, my God, look at the damage to that. And I said, y'all.
That's not damage.
It's exactly what it looked like. It just has a little water around it.
Exactly. I would agree with the caller that it does raise questions about poverty and people who are trapped in poverty. But a lot of the fact that we're talking about Katrina, the reason we're talking about Katrina today is that the flood walls were poorly engineered by the Army Corps of Engineers. Had that not been the case, had the walls been built the way they were supposed to be built, it would be maybe a blip on America's historical radar, but it wouldn't have been the full-scale catastrophe that it is today. I agree that we need to address poverty and issues such as that, and we need to give the poor and help the poor establish better places to live other than large-scale public housing developments. But the overall story about Katrina is the failure of engineering, just the very, very bad, fatal job that the Army Corps of Engineers did.
Then let me just say that you're listening to On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon. Yes.
Jackie, I just want to add a dissent to what my colleagues have just said.
Jason?
Yes, Jason Berry. The housing projects certainly had more than their share of social pathologies, drugs, unwed pregnancies, violence. But the buildings themselves, at least in most of the areas that were demolished, were very sound, solidly built structures. They dated to the New Deal. They were not the towering public housing developments that you had at, for example, Cabrini Green in Chicago that were ultimately demolished. You got to remember that people were clamoring to come back. The working poor were trying to come back. And I think I would quote Bishop Charles Jenkins, who recently retired as the Episcopal Bishop of New Orleans. He launched an affordable housing project with support of the National Episcopal Church, and nothing like that happened in the city. The mayor and the city council really, I think, are a case study in social Darwinism. They wanted to keep the poor from coming back. That's what Jenkins said. He said it's not an urban myth. There's been a concerted effort to prevent the poor from returning. And I think that's absolutely the case. Wynton Marcellus, whom I mentioned earlier, was on Tavis Smiley the same day that Congressman Richard Baker from Baton Rouge said, God did what we could never do, you know, get rid of public housing. And Wynton said that people here are blues people and they will respond and return. And in fact, to me, the epic after story of Katrina is how so many people who march in these second-line clubs, who come from these gospel churches, who are from the roots culture of these neighborhoods, have managed at great struggle to return. So I think your caller, Daniel, really hit the nail on the head. I don't know how to tie that to what's going on in the national economy, though.
Well,
what are Ray Nagin's approval ratings right now?
25%.
25%?
Yes, and that's generous.
Uh-huh. That's pretty good.
Yes, I would say that's generous as well.
We're going out on Kermit Ruffins with high heel sneakers. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the city of New Orleans, its present and future. We're joined this hour by three New Orleans voices. Jarvis DeBerry is editorial writer and columnist for the Times-Picayune. Julia Reed is a contributing editor at Newsweek and author of The House on First Street, My New Orleans Story. And Jason Berry is an author and investigative reporter and co-author of Up from the Cradle of Jazz, New Orleans Music Since World War II. And let's go to John, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Welcome to the program, John.
I'm sitting in my living room drinking coffee, looking at my Jazz Fest posters, and there's not a day gone by in the last 4 years I haven't thought about New Orleans. I love the town.
Thank you.
I haven't been back, and before I continue, I just a big congratulations to WWL. During that period of time, I strained in my AM radio and listened to the coverage, almost live coverage, for week after week coming from New Orleans, and they should get a Pulitzer for that coverage. I don't know if they did or not, but it was unreal. And it brought tears to my eyes, knowing the city I loved was going through that that pain. And I would.
Why haven't you been back, John?
I don't know. I don't know if it's psychological. I don't know what it is, but I just have not been back. I'm afraid that the culture, the charm of the city, as it was, is gone.
No, I hope. We can prove it. Just get on a plane.
We're waiting for you, John. We're waiting
this
for you, pal.
This year's Jazz Fest had a good poster, John. It could be on your wall.
Yeah, I'm sure. Hey, I follow the websites and I look at the schedules for the upcoming Jazz Fest all the time, and I don't know what it is that I haven't been back yet, but. Believe me, I will get back.
Well, it sounds to me, John, like New Orleans needs you, and you need New Orleans, and I hope you get there. Let's take another call. Steve is calling from Concord, Massachusetts.
Well, what a contrast. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Steve.
I've not missed the Jazz Fest in the last 10 years, and particularly went right after Katrina.
We appreciate it.
Of the most moving experiences I ever had were all the musicians who came back who had to leave the city because their housing had been destroyed. Coming back, it was the most moving Jazz Fest I can ever remember. So two questions, really, for your guests. The Corps of Engineers is really the source of the problem, the levees that were inadequate, that was known to be inadequate 3 years earlier, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative report in the Times-Picayune, talking about what would happen exactly as it happened. And yet no one's taken responsibility. When is it? I mean, the Bush abomination is one thing to try and cover up, but why is not the Corps of Engineers being held responsible? Why is not the rebuilding of what is obviously one of our greatest cultural icons in all of our country being taken care of by the country? You know, this, New Orleans is not something out there. It's unique as Washington, D.C., as Monticello, as some of the great historical icons we have in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's put that question to the three of you. What is the state of the levees today and also the wetland rebuilding that needed to take place?
Well, I think the wetlands rebuilding is one of the most important things we can do. I mean, without that buffer, you know, in a few years, we don't have to have a Category 5 or even a Category 3 or 4 hurricane. If one comes up the river, you know, we're done for. I mean, you can make the case that a tropical storm will take out New Orleans pretty soon if we don't restore those wetlands. But it's very hard. You know, we're talking to people here on the phone from Iowa and Massachusetts. The senators and congressmen in Iowa and Massachusetts want their own little, you know, bridge to nowhere, Ted Stevens boondoggle, which is so famous. But there's a million little pieces of pork like that in every bill, and so it's hard to make the case that, you know, when you get down to those kind of that kind of politics, legislative politics, New Orleans has got to have this much, and you don't get to promise your air base to the good folks in Oklahoma or whatever.
And at the same time, you have a Corps of Engineers that has basically resisted congressional legislation. The Congress will say, do this, and the Corps, we feel like doing this instead.
Yeah, there's incredible lack of oversight.
Correct, and it's frustrating. It is incredibly frustrating that the Corps continues to be so defiant.
Well, Jarvis DeBerry, one of the questions I threw out at the beginning of this was, does the president need to appoint some sort of, you know, Gulf Coast or Katrina or, you know, New Orleans czar? Would that help?
Well, we have a Julia groan.
I
we have a
groan.
Federal Gulf
How about
Coast
just vacationing there?
Already.
How about if he just vacations there?
Yeah, no, I mean, czars make me nervous, and they end up just it's like more of our tax dollars at work for the czar to be hanging out in New Orleans, and then nothing happens. You know, I think there just needs to be strong political will, and you know, that needs to come from the top. I mean, people bitched that, you know, Bush did too little too late as far and, you know, didn't keep on rallying the tribe. I mean, there is a reason why they call it the bully pulpit. You know, Obama came here and during the election many times and made this a big thing. I don't think he's mentioned the word New Orleans since he's been president. And admittedly, he's got a lot on his plate. But, I mean, we do need some cheerleading. It would have been great for us if he'd been not in Martha's Vineyard this weekend, but in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. The focus of his radio address Saturday, but I do agree that we would like to see more attention from the top.
I'd like to be a bit more specific, if I may, Jackie, about your question. The Army Corps of Engineers does not function with any regulatory oversight. There is no equivalent of the GAO. that can come in and investigate the Army Corps and tell them you have failed on these fronts and you have to repair. The closest thing that ever happened to that was when the National Science Academy did an elaborate investigation after Katrina and found a range of flaws and failures by the Army Corps. So even though, you know, we're living in a very overheated political environment at this time, you know, healthcare being the chief issue, the rise in sea level is not just an issue that affects New Orleans. It affects many seaboard areas of this country. And wherever the Army Corps functions as the government's line of defense, there has to be some scientific consensus that oversees them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it means creating a huge layer of bureaucracy, but there's got to be some accountability, and right now, structurally, there is none.
Right.
And I agree with Julia. We have to have the political will. The Netherlands, since the 1950s, have vowed this is not going to happen to us again.
You can do it. It's easy. I mean,
just
you got
to
get the money
to it. Right. Yes.
I will say this, and I know you've got callers, but you know, some of the early criticism that we all heard was, you know, why should we help you when you guys hadn't done a damn thing to help yourselves? You know, look at your government. Then we reelected Ray Nagin. We got a lot of flack for that. But in fact, on the local level, and I'm pretty sure that my colleagues here would agree with me, citizens here did get a wake-up call. I mean, you know, I think people had been kind of like just kind of content to watch the city roll into the sea there for a little bit. I mean, there's that famous laissez-faire attitude and let the good times roll and all that stuff. But I think people finally figured out you do get the government you deserve. Ray Nagin would not be reelected now, as we just
and there's another mayoral election coming up next year, I believe.
But what we have done is on the local level, we've done everything we can. We forced the legislature to consolidate these levy boards, which is, you know, we had 24 levy boards that were supposed to be looking at the care and maintenance of the levies. It's too arcane to get into here, but the citizens, you know, and the legislature voted us down to keep this from happening, getting people who weren't political appointees and people who, you know, were just somebody's buddy. People who are real engineers to sit on this board. We made that happen, lobbied the legislature after they voted it down once, whereas, you know, two or three years, I mean, like before the storm, you just would have said, oh, what you going to do? That's that wacky legislature, and roll your eyes. I mean, that was the classic New Orleans line was always, what you going to do? You know, just what you going to do and throw up your hands.
So a lot
that
more
does
energy,
not happen.
A lot more political will. Let's get a couple callers in here. We'll just take the calls in succession for a moment. Catherine is calling from Greenwich, Connecticut. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, y'all. I do know what it means to love New Orleans. Julia, we met in January of 2006 at the Rebirth of New Orleans.
Hi, yeah.
And I belong to a Creole association, and many of our members suffered terrifically during Katrina. All of them are back. Our Creole association is stronger than ever. I tell everyone to go back to New Orleans. The World War II Museum is just as good as it was. In fact, they're, as you know, adding a multi-million dollar addition. The Ogden Museum of Southern Art has always got something fabulous going on, and the farmers market is back, and it's just as good as it was in August of 2005.
Okay.
I just think there's a lot of work to be done, and I think you all are doing a terrific job, and I just want to thank you, and I think I can thank you for the members of La Creole.
Well, thank you for being so supportive.
Indeed. I would just like to add one small footnote to what the good lady just said. You know, the first museum that opened in New Orleans after the flood was not the Ogden, not the New Orleans Museum of Art, not the Contemporary Art Center, but it was a little museum called the Backstreet, which is housed in an old funeral home in the Treme neighborhood by a guy named Sylvester Francis, who was the founder. Sylvester was flooded out of his home in the Ninth Ward. He spent a month in Dallas, different parts of Louisiana, staying on the couches of friends. He and his wife managed to get back, and he opened that museum that he had founded in a building for which he pays $1 a year, and it was the first museum to reopen. It is a temple to the Mardi Gras Indians and the jazz funerals, the second line culture. I've got a whole section on that in Up from the Cradle of Jazz. I hold that out as an example of the roots culture and the resilience of people who come from more modest backgrounds but who were just as determined to come back, and many of whom have, despite the resistance of elected officials to help them.
I was in the city.
Yeah, go ahead.
One more point to add to Jason's. I was in the city the week after the storm. I came back into the city after a brief evacuation, and I interviewed a man named Robert Thomas on the streets of Treme, and he was resisting the government's efforts to leave the city. And I will never forget his question. He said, if I leave New Orleans, where the hell am I going to be after that? And that, more than anything, summarizes the the philosophy of the people who love this city.
Well, but not everybody who loves it was able to stay. Let's take a call from Carl, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Carl.
Hi. Hello?
Yes, hello, Carl.
Hi.
Okay, well, I was content with listening to the show, and I'm going to give you a little, let you know where I'm coming from with this. I'm half my family is from New Orleans, Louisiana, or from around that area. I mean, half. My mother's whole side of the family is from there. So I'm talking from which I know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And one of the gentlemen said that it's something that really struck me. He was talking about one of the projects in New Orleans and said it was structurally sound. And I'm thinking to myself, really? The St. Thomas, the Magnolia, the Fisher Projects, take away all the crime, the teen pregnancy, and the murder, and the drugs, but those places was festering, pus-filled sores on New Orleans, an embarrassment to the United States of America to have places like that existing in our country. Katrina, for good or bad, it did something. It lifted the ugly, nasty little secret of New Orleans, of poverty. I used to try and explain the poverty of that city to people that had never been there before or had only been there just to party. And I was like, no, you can't go there just to party. You have to know the dirty little secret of poverty in that city. And no one ever could fully understand what I was talking about until after Katrina. Like, oh my God, like Casablanca, the movie Casablanca. I had no idea it was gambling going on in Casablanca.
Well, it certainly strikes me that it is we look at New Orleans in a far more complex way today, right?
Yes, yeah. Indeed. And I would just like to respond to the gentleman. I understand what he's saying. The housing projects had many problems. I would never deny that. But, you know, some of those buildings were well-built. The Fisher Project was built much later, and he's right. It was a mess. But here's the point. There were people who held leases, bona fide leases, who wanted to come back and wanted to go to work, and their own local government, in league with Bush's HUD department, said, no, you can't come. We're going to tear these down. And so here are people who are trying to get back. Not everybody in those housing projects, would qualify as a drug user, a drug dealer. There were a lot of good people clamoring to get back, and they couldn't. So I think there is a basic issue of fairness here, and that's not to romanticize the poverty in any way.
Well, whatever you think about the fate of the housing projects, and none of us are going to agree on that completely, but one thing that was wiped out was the school system, and that was a humongous silver lining because we had a dysfunctional school system taking place in buildings that might have been structurally sound but had been condemned, some of them. And so when you're talking about poverty, the root of a lot of the poverty in this city and anywhere else is a lack of education. I mean, if somebody can't read and write, forget it. I mean, it's why we don't have an economy here. It's why we always had a tourist economy. That's why the folks who were living in these housing projects were, barely making minimum wage, working as maids in hotels because that's all we had as jobs. So the school system right now is being rebuilt into whatever it ends up being. It'll be a far more functional collection of institutions than it was. And that is our best hope, to get rid of poverty, to get some real industry in town. We have a huge collection of charter schools and public schools that are operating at a level that we have not, that I certainly hadn't seen since I've been in this city.
Well, that's certainly ending on a positive note, and I think you would probably all say that people ought to come and get their own assessment, right?
Yes, definitely.
Well, I really want to thank
Please.
You all for talking with us. Jarvis DeBerry, Julia Reed, Jason Berry. It's been a real pleasure, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And we're going to leave you with Crescent City Calypso by Dr. Michael White. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.